Hello, you are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl, and I am your friendly neighborhood tech for today. Lauren is out of the studio, but we do have a brand new show for you today. Lauren spoke yesterday with a man named Philip Armstrong. I will leave the introductions to her when I play the tape. But first, we have a couple of things to get to, and it's a couple of very quick announcements before we get into the show. We got an email from some listeners in Western New York, actually from the Buffalo area, and it's great to know that we have listeners out there. This comes to us from Vicky America, and she's with the Animal Advocates of Western New York, and they're having a film screening, actually, in the next week or so. It's a little bit of short notice, but if you are in the Buffalo area, be sure to check it out. That's happening on October 9th and 10th. And Andrea Cimino, campaign coordinator for the Humane Society of the United States, is joining the festival as a guest speaker, presenting on the Canadian seal slaughter during both nights of the first annual film festival presented by Animal Advocates of Western New York. Again, it's October 9th and 10th. The film screenings are all free and open to the public, which is also a great thing. Be sure to check that out. For more information, go to www.animalswny.org. So that's www.animalswny.org. And those are all the announcements for the show. So, like I said before, Lauren is away for the day, but she spoke with Philip Armstrong all the way in New Zealand yesterday. That's part of the reason why he couldn't do the show at 11 a.m., because he would be awake at 5. So this is a pre-recorded program. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman. Today we're speaking with Philip Armstrong, who is at the University of Canterbury in the School of Culture, Literature and Society in the English program, which involves the analysis of human-animal relationships as expressed in cultural representations and practices, especially in the context of colonialism, decolonization and globalization. Philip Armstrong is also the director of the New Zealand Center for Human-Animal Studies, which includes scholars from the humanities and social sciences. He's also the editor of a text called Knowing Animals, and his book, What Animals Mean in the Fiction of Modernity, is about to be published with Routledge. And I'm very pleased to welcome to the program Philip Armstrong. So Philip, thank you for being here today and waking up incredibly early to do this interview.
Thank you very much for having me. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, so it's not actually too early.
So, Philip, I was really interested in speaking with you because I had the opportunity to actually teach an article that you wrote called The Postcolonial Animal, and that's first what got me introduced to your work. But, of course, as typical of many academics, you certainly do a lot of different work as well. But I wanted to talk about starting off from that first place that I met you, which was through The Postcolonial Animal, and tell us a little bit about postcolonial theory and how you got started thinking about these issues in reference to animals.
Sure. Well, I started off in life as an academic, as a sort of specialist in postcolonial theory and writing. I was hired to teach a postcolonial literature course and so on, so that's what I started with, and with no particular interest in human-animal relations at that time. It was about 10 years ago. And I think that what's happened in postcolonial theory has been postcolonial theory has always been very committed to historical analysis, obviously, of the politics and the cultural politics of colonialism and what happens in its aftermath. But I think that that's tended more in the direction of thinking about globalization and thinking about colonial history or the history of European imperialism as part of a larger history of globalization, so that globalization is not just something, you know, that happened since the Second World War, or that has happened in the last few decades, but actually something that, you know, goes back to Columbus and beyond. And teaching that stuff and thinking about that stuff, I began to be aware that one of the things that postcolonial theory does is that it questions humanism, I suppose you'd say. It questions the humanist tradition, and it questions the whole idea of the relationship between the human and the non-human world that Europeans brought with them when they colonized other countries and other people, and that were then often imposed on other cultures. And that can mean a couple of different things. It can mean the non-human world in terms of the spiritual world, which is something that the humanist tradition gradually became more and more separated from, but it can also mean the non-human world, as in the animal world, the environment, and so on. And at the same time, I was becoming more politicized in regard to human-animal relations in my life outside the university, and that influenced me, and various people influenced me, to start thinking about those questions in relation to my academic work. And it seemed to me that not all that many people had thought about this link between the politics of post-colonialism or the politics of critical studies of globalization and human-animal relationships. So that's what I started to do.
Can you give us some concrete examples of how this has played out in your work, or particular sites or issues that you've looked at where you've tried to bring together this interest in human-animal studies and post-colonial theory?
Yeah, sure. Well, the course that I teach at fourth-year level is called Animals and Settlement, and one of the things that I like to start with is by talking about a really well-known classic text. You know, some people would say it's at the very origins of the novel in English, which is this Robinson Crusoe. And when we think of Robinson Crusoe, it's often taken as a story about, almost like a parable of European settlement of other places. Robinson Crusoe goes to an island and he establishes a European style culture, a European style economy on the island just by himself. And sometimes this is taken as a paradigm of capitalism, you know, the sort of self-made man creating an economy from nothing. And also of colonization, creating a whole new structure in this sort of terra nullius, this land that belongs to no one, supposedly. But of course, what enables him to do that is the animal life present on the island, and no one really seemed to me had thought about this too much. And in particular, it's the goats. He has some cats, and he has a dog that have survived the shipwreck and come ashore with him. But it's the goats that enable him to survive, because first of all he hunts them, and then he captures some and he tames them up, and then he breeds them, and then he encloses various plots of land in order to keep his flock safe, and then he creates new flocks in case he's like an investor, you know, he sort of he diversifies his portfolio because he thinks, well, if cannibals come to the island and wipe out one of my flocks, you know, where am I going to be then? All this hard work over years will be gone. So he creates other flocks and so on, and he doesn't like to put all his eggs in one basket. And I thought about this, and it's a sort of little parable of the development of what was then a modern agricultural economy, using enclosure and using farming techniques to breed them and so on, selective breeding and such like. And I thought, well, why are the goats there? And of course, Defoe puts the island in the mouth of the Orinoco River. He invents an island, but it's all based on the story of Alexander Selkirk, who was a Scottish sailor marooned on the Juan Fernandez Islands, which are actually in the Pacific. They're just off. They're some way off the coast of Chile. And Selkirk was marooned there in the early 18th century, and he hunted goats in order to survive. And the goats were only there. Goats are not endemic to Juan Fernandez Islands. They were brought there by Juan Fernandez, who was a Spanish sailor who discovered the islands in the 16th century and who took goats and chickens there, because this was something that Europeans did at the time. It was part of their program of colonization, part of their program of discovery and what we would now call globalization. It was called seeding, and they would seed oceanic islands with livestock, which would then go feral and multiply and survive, or not survive. In this case, the goats survived and the chickens didn't. And they could then be used by subsequent voyages. They could then be harvested, as it were, by subsequent voyages and their trips around the globe. So it's part of the way Europe put its fingers out, if you like, towards the rest of the globe. And that's the reason there were goats on Selkirk's island, and that's the reason there are goats on Crusoe's island. So for me, this is an example of something that a man called Alfred Crosby referred to as biological imperialism. Mm-hmm. The fact that imperialism, globalization, always occurs not just in relation to territories or peoples, but in relation to other life forms as well. And animals are an absolutely fundamental part of imperialism.
Have some people who study post-colonial theory, or when they find out what you're trying to do in terms of bringing in the animals into focus in some way and showing how they're bound up in this post-colonial theory that I think often is conceived as of in sort of purely human terms, although you do mention Crosby, and there is this sort of ecological notion, I think, to some of the literature, but is there a kind of nervousness that you're somehow going to be undermining the broadly conceived post-colonial project, which is, you know, to look at these assumptions and also to take that critical perspective into our current understanding of globalization?
I was a bit nervous about that when I started, because particularly in my field, in literary studies, there has been a history of a sort of trivialization, if you like, of concern about non-human animals. And so I was a bit concerned about that. I'm not sure if that's quite what you mean, but that was one of the things that concerned me. But in fact, I haven't found that. I've found that those who are in the post-colonial fields have been very interested in this kind of work. And I mean, another dimension to it, I've just talked about the sort of biological imperialism side of it, but another dimension to it is the whole question of cultural difference. And I think that what post-colonial studies or globalization studies bring to the academic table is a series of theories and approaches that help us to think about what happens when cultures interact, different cultures, when they come into conflict, when one tries to, you know, override or efface another one, cultural resistance, or when they mix and blend and exchange cultural forms and cultural content. And I think human-animal relations need to be considered as part of that, of all those negotiations, because both at a practical level and a conceptual level, they're in that mix. At a conceptual level, ideas about what it means to be human, as I've said, ideas about what it means to live in the world and to interact with non-human nature and so on, all these things are challenged in what Mary-Louise Pratt called the contact zone, you know, the kind of zone of overlap between cultures. And at a practical level, this works itself out at two, because in all sorts of ways, the history of colonialism and post-colonialism show that it's in human-animal relations that cultures cross over and their values come into conflict or are hybridized or are challenged or are changed or whatever. I can give you an example of that, if you like, in the New Zealand context, which is that the first long-term European settlers, the first Europeans to really settle here rather than just visit, were whalers. They established shore whaling stations all around both islands, particularly on the east coast and the south coast, during the 1820s. And they were a population of settlers who interacted very thoroughly with the local Māori, as they had to, because there were very few Europeans here. They were entirely reliant on local Māori for food, for supplies, and for protection from other Māori iwi who might otherwise have been hostile towards them. Often they would intermarry. They became quite bicultural. Many of them would learn some Māori, and Māori would learn English from them. And what developed then was a series of these more or less bicultural communities which were harvesting right whales around the shore of New Zealand. Now, from the point of view of sort of cultural difference and cultural interaction, this seems, in the light of some of New Zealand's other history, almost idyllic. You know, he was a bicultural community. Of course, from the point of view of the animals, from an environmental point of view, it was a complete disaster because they did shore whaling because right whale mothers would come into shore, come into the bays where the water was warm and shallow to nurse on their migration routes. And the whalers would go out in their boats and they would kill the calf, which was very easy to kill because it was young and inexperienced and often curious. They would drag it to shore, and the mother would sometimes follow without even needing to be harpooned herself because she was trying to help her calf. So it was a very easy pickings in relation to other whaling, but it was a complete disaster because it absolutely decimated the whales, and the whole thing collapsed after about two decades. So what you have there is a complex of interactions between humans, animals, and different cultural groups And one of the things that happens is a, you know, which seems regrettable in hindsight, and to some people saw that it was regrettable at the time, that Māori culture had had a particular attitude to whales, which regarded them often as taniwha, and that there's no evidence that Māori went whaling prior to European arrival here. They used to kill whales that were beached, but they didn't go out to sea to hunt them. But from that point on, Māori became quite avid hunters of whales. So you have, you know, a culture that had been isolated for quite a long time, being exposed to new cultures and new cultural values, and changing its attitudes, changing its practices in relation to animals. And these are the kinds of intermixture and exchange that, that interest me very much from a post-colonial and an animal studies point of view.
I think when some people think about cultural difference and issues around race and ethnicity in terms of human-animal studies, texts like Marjorie Spiegel's The Dreaded Comparison come to mind, and you take up this question of analogies in the Postcolonial Animal, the article that was part of Society and Animals, and you make an interesting claim, and I hope that we could talk about it a bit further, because you're not drawing analogies necessarily in saying the treatment of humans is the same or analogous somehow to the treatment of animals. You're proposing something different, and you also make the claim that those types of analogies, those types of comparisons, the equation between the treatment of animals and humans, you say, fails to advance us either to advance us in terms of post-colonial studies or animal studies very far. And I was wondering if you could talk more about that.
Yeah, I think I still think that. I wrote that article when I was first getting into this area, and that certainly seemed to be the case to me then. Subsequently, I've read Spiegel again. I've read Charles Patterson's book, Eternal Treblinka, which, of course, is about the links between treatment of animals in the 20th century and the Holocaust, which is another one of these analogies that is very often made by animal rights people between the Holocaust and say, industrial farming or vivisection.
We've had both of those authors on the program, and also last week we had a group called Animal Rights Africa and the author of a book called Animals in South Africa. And throughout the text, one of the those examples is between animals, the treatment of animals and humans under apartheid, which I thought from my North American perspective was a new analogy to be drawn, at least new for me. So if you could comment on that, I would love to hear your thoughts.
I mean, I think those are terrific, but I don't know the South African example. I'd be very interested to see it. But I think Patterson's book and Spiegel's book, I think they're wonderful books. And they're wonderful books because they start with the analogy, and then they go beyond it. And they go beyond it to look at a sort of, at a technology, and also at an ideology. So a series of practices and a series of concepts that enable both certain populations of humans who are seen as less than human, who are seen as bestial, they enable both those populations and non-human animals to be treated in some of the same ways. So according to industrial scale technologies for mass movement of populations, mass processing, mass slaughter, mass confinement, and so on. And I think when those writers are talking about those technological links and those material links, those links in practice and the ideological links, I think their work is very powerful and convincing. And I can well imagine that the same kind of approach might pay off in South Africa and in other parts of the world too. On the other hand, I think I still would say that simply used as an analogy, the comparison, you know, it remains a dreaded comparison, if you like. It remains a comparison that falls short of achieving what it should according to the actual connections between those practices, which are real ones. And it falls short, I think, because of a lingering, and I don't think that this will ever change, a lingering problem in the rhetoric of animal activism, where as soon as you put it alongside some great maltreatment of humans, people will say, oh, but you can't even compare the two things, because as a species we're inclined to value the lives of our own species more than others, But also we have this long, long history of, you know, especially in Western-style cultures, of extraordinary denigration of animals. And these terrible, these particular kinds of animal abuse can only happen because we do that, because we denigrate animals and we see them as less than nothing, certain kinds of animals. And so that prejudice, if you like, still remains when we make that comparison. And Marjorie Spiegel makes this point. She and James Patterson, I'm more than aware of it. Charles Patterson, I beg your pardon. And so I think from an activist point of view and from the point of view of public rhetoric, I would always tend to stay away from those analogies because in their simple, obvious, apparent form, they're unhelpful. Yet when you look at why, you know, the material and practical and historical basis for the analogy, when you look at the actual connections, those are very real and very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit more about activism, because I know that in addition to your academic work, you also have done activist work. And because your main area has been on literature and English, I know that sometimes people can see that as a bit detached from, you know, making real, so-called real action in the world. And this is a question that I pose to Kerry Wolfe as well, that, you know, there's an incredible kind of urgency, I think, for animal issues, especially when you're, I think a lot of activists are just, when they first come to the issues, and remain so as well, just horrified by the extent of the terrible animal treatment that's happening globally. And then, you know, someone comes along and wants to talk to us about Moby Dick. And it's a bit difficult sometimes to make the case why that's important. So I guess the first question in that is, what's the relevance of studying literature for animal activism? Is there a link there? And also, if you could explain a little bit about, given your critiques of animal activism, the types of activism that you've been involved with and what you think is useful.
Those are two great good questions, aren't they?
I'm glad I had you laughing through part of them.
I'm astonished that you know anybody who could say that reading Moby Dick isn't the most urgent thing we could possibly do. But actually, and joking aside, I think mainly the advantages of the connection between animal activism and academic human-animal studies work, whether it's in literature or cultural studies or sociology or wherever it is, I think the advantages accrue to the academic work, mainly. That is to say that from my point of view, it's animal activism that leads the way. In my experience, and I know a lot of animal activists, and they have influenced me very strongly, and I've learned a great deal from them, they are what's sometimes referred to as organic intellectuals. You know, they're people not necessarily, in fact, mainly, not with advanced degrees in tertiary study, but they're people who are extremely well-read, and they've developed extremely sophisticated conceptual means and instruments for thinking about human-animal relationships. They're very, very savvy when they approach the media. They're very aware of what's going on in the world. They're extremely sophisticated users of contemporary means of communication. They have a very, very sophisticated sense of how they can make use of public rhetoric and so on. And, you know, I don't actually feel as a literature academic or as a cultural studies academic that I have too much to teach them. I think they have an awful lot to teach me. So for me, literary studies, cultural studies are being informed by, you know, every now and then literary studies and cultural studies need a shot of reality, if you like, need an injection of political and social reality that energizes us and that reminds us that what we're doing should have a function in the real world. And I think animal activism has provided that in literary studies. So that for me, most of the advantages accrue to the university work from the activists outside, if you like. And I guess one of the things, the payback, I suppose I would say, for animal activism is that one of the things that it hasn't been very good at achieving, at least certainly not in this part of the world, is strong and authoritative access to the education system, either high school or indeed primary school or high school or university level. And that's a big lack, a very big lack. I mean, the education system is, you know, remains, of course, one of the most powerful ideological apparatuses in a society like ours. And so I would see the role of academics who are doing work in this area as giving access to the kinds of very real and very important questions that animal activists are raising in the public sphere, providing an access point for those questions to enter into the education system. And so, I mean, one of the things I'm most excited about here is working with somebody who is developing a curriculum called Animals and Us, which is a human-animal studies program, basically, for use in secondary schools. And it's been designed in ways that are completely compatible with our examination systems and our official curriculums in English and social studies and history and so on. And that seems to me an immensely powerful thing. And so I guess that would be my answer, is that I think that once academic work has taken on board the questions that activists have raised, it can then give something back to activism by giving it access to the education system, and that seems very powerful to me. Mm.
And in terms of the second question, then...
I've forgotten that one.
What directions, or what do you think is useful in terms of animal activism today? I know that you've been an activist yourself for a while, so maybe you could comment on that as well.
My first answer would be the one that I've just given, really, is that I think that there's a huge potential for animal activism in the education system, in the official education system. And I think that now that activism has... it seems to me it's contemporary animal activism is getting over its sort of unruly adolescent phase, where really it was most keen on getting arrested at protests and making a fuss and getting in trouble and so on. And I mean, I don't mean to be too dismissive of those things, because I actually think they still play an incredibly important part. And we wouldn't be where we are now without people having done those things. And there are situations in which there's still really important means of communication. But I think that in the last 10 or 20 years, animal activism, certainly here, has begun to realize that it has to do more than that, and it has to be able to speak to the majority of people. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to do for a movement whose ultimate aims are some extremely radical changes in the organization of society. It's a very difficult thing to do, to present that in a palatable form without watering it down. And I think the education system can help with that. And that might sound a bit odd, because we think of the education system probably as being fairly conservative. But young people are not conservative, and young people come into education prepared to question anything and keen to question everything. And if, as teachers and as university lecturers and as mentors of young people, we can find ways of allowing them to do that, encouraging them to do that, then I think that's there are real forward progress to be made there. I mean, the other thing that makes animal activism hugely, I think, a politics of the moment is that it's one of the things that it's about is encouraging people to become more critical inhabitants of a late consumer capitalist society. That by encouraging people to think very carefully and to interrogate the ways in which the consumer goods that they're exposed to are produced, it's one of a number of ways. I mean, environmentalism is its closest relative in this respect, but so are things like the fair trade movement, of course, and movements towards justice for workers and so on. These are all ways of saying to people, well, you know, you're thrown into, as a citizen of post-industrial societies, you're thrown into this late capitalist consumer culture. What power do you have? What agency do you have to question it and to say, well, the politics and the practices behind these goods are unacceptable to me, and they have to change? And I think animal rights has one set of questions and one set of answers to that, which is very powerful.
Mm. One of the things that happens in Canada sometimes in the popular debates, mainstream media, is that animal rights is really seen as in opposition to a lot of human struggles. At least it's constructed that way in the media. So around the fur trade or fur trapping, it'll be seen, the animal rights perspective will be seen as inherently an anti-First Nations or an anti-Native perspective. That plays out as well in the rhetoric, both I think within the movement and also within the mainstream media's perception that, you know, the sealing industry here is a huge national debate that happens every year. And sometimes the, as I said, the animal activist position is seen as really being part of a continuing discourse of racism. And I think in some ways that it is, and in some ways it isn't, depending on who's speaking and on what terms. But I'm wondering about that sort of what gets perceived as a collision of rights. So when you have an Indigenous community that's perhaps doing something that often a largely white, middle-class, privileged group is saying is wrong, how do we negotiate some of those tensions, or what are perceived as tensions between different sets of rights?
It's probably the curliest question, I think, in this field that we're talking about, this context of post-colonial and human-animal studies. And your guess is right. I mean, the same thing does happen here, and it certainly happens across the Tasman and Australia also. It happens a lot in our part of the world, particularly with environmentalists in relation to certain kinds of Indigenous land use and treatment of non-human Native animals. And I think there's a few things that a post-colonially inflicted thought could bring to these kind of situations. One, of course, is a sense of history, a sense of colonial history, that in fact, very often these practices, which are said to be Indigenous practices, are strongly influenced by and impacted upon by the history of colonialism. And I'm thinking, for example, of the Makah people in the northwest coast of America, who wanted to resume, and did resume, whaling a few years ago at the start of the 21st century. And very much this kind of thing happened. The Sea Shepherd people went in there, and the Makah said they were being colonialist, and the Sea Shepherd people said that the Makah were being environmentally irresponsible and so on. So very much the kind of collision that you're talking about. But I think that from a post-colonial point of view, there's a couple of things to learn from that. And one is that what the Makah were trying to do, and this was made clear from the way that they talked about it, was to regain, especially for their young people, some sense of cultural identity and some kind of purpose, spiritual purpose, and cultural purpose. And they, for them, they said this centered on the tradition of whaling. So one would need to think very carefully about the history of colonial disenfranchisement that brings a people to the point where that is necessary. So that would be one thing that a post-colonial approach would consider, and would say, you know, what other kinds of response to that history might there be? The other thing that a post-colonial history of that event would bring in would be to say that the Makah emphasis on whaling, arguably in the 19th century, was in part a result of colonization and globalization in the first place. One of the reasons the Makah signed the Treaty of Nea Bay with the local governor, which preserved their right to whaling. They gave up an awful lot of their land in order to have their right to whaling preserved, and one can imagine the kind of pressure that they would have felt under in order to do that. But of course, by giving up land and saying they would dedicate themselves to whaling, they centered their culture much more strongly on whaling and the income from whaling. And the reason that this suited the governor was not just because he got a whole lot of land, but because it was the 1840s, the 1850s, and whale oil provided the lubricant and the fuel for the industrialization of America in the period. And the Makah became a major contributor to the supply of whale oil for industry in the period. So that focus on whaling is itself affected by colonial exchanges and so on historically. So I think a post-colonial approach can bring awareness of that kind of history, which, you know, is not perhaps immediately helpful, you know, when the boats are out there shouting insults at each other, but in the way that the debate is framed and talked about, it can be helpful. Hmm. Perhaps more immediately, practically helpful, I think that a post-colonial approach would also recognize that what's needed, and this was a point made by a very fine eco-feminist critic called Greta Gard about the Makah situation. She said that what was needed in the situation was, if you like, cross-cultural translators. Mm-hmm. That is, people who were aware of and respected by the culture in question, who could negotiate the kinds of cultural difference at work, the difference in cultural values at work. And for that to happen, there needs to be an awareness that, you know, just as animal rights is not just one thing, you know, there's not just one set of values called animal rights, one set of values called environmentalism, which everybody holds to, so that everybody associated with that will make the same judgment in every situation. That is also true of cultural groups, whether it be the Makah or whether it be Maori in New Zealand or whoever it is, that, of course, there are differing views, there are differing values, there are differing histories, there are different positions, and that in a conflict, positions tend to become concretized. They tend to become seen as monolithic, and sometimes people will make their position more monolithic because they feel their people are being attacked or whatever. But that usually what is the case, if you dig down, is that things are much more complex than that, and there are people who feel, you know, equivocal on both sides, and if those people can talk to each other, then maybe the cause can be advanced in that way.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the essay Sympathy, and I also wanted to hear about your new book that is about to be published through Routledge, called What Animals Mean in the Fiction of Modernity. And I was really moved by your essay called Sympathy that was a prize winner through Lantern. And you talk about having an experience of knowing a chicken who came and knocked on your door one day, and that you and your partner got to know. And then the hen got sick, and so you and your partner ended up taking her to the vet, and you were confronted by this disheartening attitude that somehow, because she was quote unquote just a chicken, that she didn't matter as much.
She was a wonderful animal. She was a wonderful animal, but there was nothing special about her. I've since known other hens, and they're wonderful animals too, you know. But one of the things that we noticed, one of the things we always notice is, you know, sometimes we get hens that have been formerly being battery hens, and because we have a little bit of space, we give them a home once they've recovered from their experience. And one of the things we've noticed is we take them to the vet for a checkup, you know, because it's extraordinarily bad for their whole system, of course, to be kept in battery cages. So we take them to the vet for a checkup. And the vet always says something very interesting, a different vet from the one I refer to in the story, obviously. We have a good vet now, and we've had a few, and they always say the same thing. They say, what a wonderful bird, or what a special hen she is. And that's interesting because, of course, when you have, one of the extraordinary things about battery hens, in my experience, is that they're unusually trusting of human beings, which seems especially ironic, but they seem to me to have no, once they've sort of recovered after a few days, they have no particular fear of human beings. They kind of associate human beings with bringing them food, I suppose. And so they are very engaging, you know, but actually all hens are very engaging, you know, they're curious animals, they're confiding, they're vigorous, and the hen that I write about in the essay was certainly all of those things, and she, because she was by herself, of course, hens hate to be by themselves, and so she would come and rap on the door with her beak, and we'd open the door, and she'd just come marching in and sit next to us while we were watching TV or whatever she wanted to do. Quite often roost with us late in the evening. But probably any hen that is by herself will do that because they seek out the company of others, and if they can't get the company of other hens, then they'll seek out human company. It will do. To me, there's something interesting there about feeling and emotion and affect and what I call sympathy in the essay. And in the book that you referred to and What Animals Mean, I try to identify this as one of the real things that the study of literature can bring to our thinking about human-animal relations, because literature and the humanities generally are about the study of things that can't be empirically proven. You know, I suppose that's why we have the humanities alongside the sciences and the social sciences, is for things that that can't be statistically proven, that can't be put on a table and studied and anatomized and so on. And one of those things, I think, is feeling emotion or affect. And literature is particularly good at conveying that. Literature, in one sense, is all about that. That's what literature is for, according to Raymond Williams, anyway, who described this as, he referred to structures of feeling, by which he meant large shared patterns of emotion or patterns of affect that were shared by many people in a culture at a given time. And I think that there's potential, in thinking like that, there's potential for trying to redress or trying to balance out or trying to challenge some of the very demeaning and diminishing and denigrating effects that capitalism and industry have on human-animal relationships. Because as long as we can leave animals hidden away, as it were, in that kind of category of industrial raw material or raw material for farming, then that capacity for emotion or affect is not engaged. As soon as it is engaged, it's an immensely powerful thing, and you can't measure it and you can't empirically study it, but it's extremely powerful, and I don't think anybody could deny that. And most socially progressive movements, when you think about them historically, have come about not because of statistics or not because people decided through empirical evidence that something was wrong, but because a structure of feeling came into force. A powerful, shared emotion came into force that said, this must stop. This is unacceptable. And often that happens, you know, because we are ourselves, I guess, a kind of gregarious species. Often that happens when we meet and encounter, at an intimate level, individuals of the group which is being exploited. And I think that's what's happening when people meet one of these hens and they say, what a remarkable bird, what an extraordinary animal. I could take any battery hen from the many, many tens of thousands that are currently caged around this country in New Zealand today and, you know, show them to a child once they'd recovered or show them to an adult, and I think they would have that experience. And in a way, if we can tap into that experience, if animal activists can tap into that experience and mobilize that structure of feeling, I think that's one thing that capitalism can't ever quite commodify, and industry can't ever quite industrialize, if you like. It remains something very powerful and something quite innate to us as human beings.
One of the big debates, as I'm sure you know, within the animal movements is what often gets framed as welfare versus rights, or reform versus abolitionism. And I'm wondering about this question of feelings, because I think for some people, the turn is towards what is considered humane meats or quote-unquote happy meats, and that would really feel like the best thing. It would seem ecologically in harmony. It would it sort of evokes this sort of pastoral scene that is, I think, very well sold to us by the meat and dairy industries of the frolicking livestock in the fields, and that would fulfill... would tap into that sort of good feeling and
would
promote
answer that structure of feeling.
Yeah. So how does an animal activist that is maybe more interested in questioning that underlying exploitation respond to that in terms of the larger conversation that you just pointed to in terms of feelings?
Yeah, it's a very important question. Recently, the animal activist group that I'm involved with has been focusing, in fact, on battery hens. And on that issue, because it's one that, I mean, I've done this. If you go out on the street and talk to people about battery hen farming, I've never had anybody say that's acceptable. You know, everybody agrees that it's completely unacceptable. It's like the bottom line. But everybody also says, but that doesn't happen here, does it? Doesn't matter how many times you do it. They always have both those responses. That's unacceptable, but that doesn't happen here. And I think partly this is because, largely, we've discovered this is because we don't have clear labelling on eggs here, so that we can have, you can go into the supermarket and you can find 12 eggs that are called happy hen eggs, and just the way that you're talking about, you know, that the idea of a happy animal happily producing products for us and nobody's really hurt in the process is being sold to you. But then those happy hens, they're from battery caged hens, because there's no control over how those kind of terms are used. So one thing that an animal activist would need to say is that the primary agricultural industries are very good and very quick at seizing on these structures of feelings and using them for marketing, and there's quite often absolutely no relationship between the structure of feeling that's being used in the advertising and the actual conditions of the animal, as in that case of, you know, happy hens on the labelling, very, very unhappy hens actually producing the eggs. But the other thing that I would say about it is, even when you have a real attempt by the industry to produce humane meat, whether that's taking animals out of industrial-style agriculture and having them on sort of family farms and so on, they have a good life up until the point that they're slaughtered and so on. There's still, to my mind, a couple of major problems with that. And one is simply, where are they all going to go? Where are we going to put them all? One of the reasons that we have industrial farming is that there are so many of us with an ever-increasing taste, appetite for meat and for milk and for animal products, that it's simply not logistically going to be possible for small family farms, happy farms, to cater for that taste. The only way you could do that would be for the consumption of animal products to be vastly scaled back in the diets of most of the people in the world. And, you know, that would be a good start. Let's do that, and then we'll see where we go from there, I suppose you could say. But, of course, that's not going to happen. Also, I'd say that the idea of the humane itself can be a bit of a false friend. And there's a very, very good essay in a book called Killing Animals, which was published by the Animal Studies Group, some of whom I think you've talked to, an essay by Jonathan Burt, where he talks about the idea of the humane in the context of animal slaughter. And he says that even in industrial farming, this idea of humane slaughter has become a powerful one. It's a powerful one because, of course, it seems to satisfy the demands of animal welfare. But in fact, he says, because humane slaughter is most often conceived as simply a function of speed, that is to say, the quicker the animal's death is, the more humane it is, supposedly, that's entirely consistent with a production system that wants to focus on efficiency and wants to push as much product through as possible and to slaughter as many animals in as short a space of time as possible. So there's all sorts of ways in which the idea of the humane can actually contribute to and reinforce the industrial use of animals as well. So we have to be very, very careful about how we use these ideas of the humane. A very good example, I think, is given in Matthew Scully's book, Dominion, where he talks about going to a large industrial hog farm in, I think it's North Carolina, and he says that, you know, the animals are, of course, in concrete and iron cages, and they can hardly turn around, and many of them have injuries, and they just lie there because they have no space or no environmental reason to do anything else. But he says he notices that there are tires hanging from the ceiling, and he asks why that is. And the man in charge of the hog farm says, well, we follow Dr. Temple Grandin's advice about behavioral enrichment. Now, Temple Grandin's a very, very interesting figure, and she's certainly somebody who, from a welfare point of view, no doubt has improved certain aspects of the lives of animals in the agricultural industry. But here's an example of a supposedly humane innovation being used purely as window dressing. I mean, these animals' lives are so miserable that there's nothing about a tire that's going to give them behavioral enrichment. But because the farm can claim that they've had advice from Temple Grandin, they will, you know, then be in conformity with certain kinds of pressure to move their production in the direction of humane processes. So it can be a very false friend, the whole idea of the humane. On the other hand, if it's used you know, there's also the point of view that says that if you take welfare steps first, then that increases people's awareness of the issues. You know, it may improve the lives of the animals somewhat, and then you can then focus on the next step so that you push things gradually, piece by piece. And in practical terms, that's usually how animal rights has to work, I think. Mm.
Philip, we're pretty much out of time.
We went
over time. Stu's cueing me. I want to say quickly thank you to Stu for doing the pre-record teching for us today. Philip, it was a great pleasure to talk to you today. There's always more to say, and I know we couldn't cover everything.
Sure.
I wanted to say again that your book that's coming out soon is What Animals Mean, and I think the full title is What Animals Mean in the Fiction of Modernity.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you also have an edited collection called Knowing Animals, which I guess is a collaborative project?
Yes, that's right. That's part of the Human Animal Studies series from edited by Ken Shapiro of the Society and Animal Journal.
Great. Thanks so much, Philip. It was great talking to you today.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it. Okay, bye.
Bye now. We were just speaking with Philip Armstrong. He's the director of the New Zealand Centre for Human-Animal Studies, and he is also part of the University of Canterbury School of Culture, Literature, and Society in the English program.
You were just listening to Animal Voices on CIUT. Coming up next is Sergio with some Latin music.